Hi, my name's Catherine Lamour. I'm here speaking with Ms. Valencia Goodridge for my project, Black Women Political Leadership Class, and we're going to be talking a little about Black women in the political sphere. Hi, Ms. Goodridge. Can you please tell us a little about yourself and who you are?
Yes, thank you, Catherine, for having me today. I am just thrilled to be here to share about the National Coalition of 100 Black Women and what I do in as far as leadership within the Greater New Haven and Bridgeport communities in the state of Connecticut. I am, as you mentioned, Valencia Goodridge. And first off, I'm going to say I am a mom of three gorgeous daughters like yourself. So I'm just thrilled to be sitting here in front of you. I'm also a wife, an advocate, and as you can see, I'm currently at work. I work as a director of family services, which in that role, I'm also an advocate for affordable housing for individuals who are marginalized within the greater Bridgeport community. But overall, if I had to describe myself in one or two words, I'd have to say I'm a woman of deep faith and a woman of gratitude, gratefulness. And humility is part of the foundation of who I really am. So I would say too that growing up in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and the projects of Bridgeport has allowed me, afforded me an opportunity to have a story that's unique, and it's actually maybe the person I am today, and you know, within the National Coalition of 100 Black Women. And advocating for gender equity in the areas of health, education, economic empowerment. So that's just kind of a nutshell who I am. Again, I say first a mom, but most importantly, an advocate for gender equity. And that's just based on my foundation and how I've grown up. And I always say that you don't know what you don't know. So I pride myself on making certain that everywhere I go, whomever I touch and whoever I talk to, we impart knowledge on them so that they have a better understanding of what maybe they didn't know. So that's kind of it. I hope that answers your question, okay.
Yeah, amazing, fabulous. Can you also share a little bit about what the work is that the National Coalition of 100 Black Women is? Maybe if some listeners haven't heard of it.
Sure. Thank you for asking. The National Coalition of 100 Black Women, we are an advocacy organization. It's a national organization. It started in 1981. So we are a young organization. When you think about Black women's groups, you have, you know, groups that are 80, 90 years old celebrating anniversaries. But within our organization, it was started by a woman who was a visionary. And she had the courage to start an advocacy group with a coalition of women, Black women. And what they decided to do, and this is back in the actually the mid-70s, in the 81, we became national, but it was initially the Coalition of Black Women. And it was founded in New York City. And what was unique about this particular organization, because you have, you know, sororities and other social groups, this was a true advocacy group. And the foundation of the organization was to really get women to consider running for political office and to get women like just aware of issues that affected Black families, issues that affected the disparities around health or around anything around gender and Black women. Just access to simple things like, for example, the way Black women were treated in the jail system. I know if you were able, I don't know if you had an opportunity to visit the website, but if you watch Edna Beach's video, when she talks about the inception of the National Coalition of 100 Black Women, she talks about how she had visited a jail and all the Black women had hair like mine, very, very short. And she asked one woman, why is everyone wearing these really short afros? And they said it was a survival mechanism, so that they wouldn't be pulled around by their hair and be taken advantage of physically. And you know what that means. So this is a way for them to just put a stop to it, to have control over their bodies by cutting their hair. So that really piqued her interest, where we need to be the voice for the voiceless. And that's how it kind of started back in the mid 70s. But fast forward to now, Actually, our first national president was Jewel Jackson McCabe. And I know you're young, I don't know if you've heard of her, but she's a legend. You'll have to Google her. But she was a true advocate. She believed in gender equity. And so out of that, we developed a mission, which was centered around advocating for Black women and girls to promote leadership development and gender equity in the areas of health, education, economic development, and of course, public policy. So public policy is the heart of what we do. We find issues, for example, most recently, we had this huge initiative around maternal health and the disparities around maternal health. I don't know if you're aware of this, but you're very young. I should say very because you're in college, but young. And one day you may decide you'd like to have children. I don't know if you're aware of this, but Black women are 3 times more likely to die during from complications giving birth. And that's one of our key initiatives right now within the New Haven Metropolitan Chapter is bringing awareness around maternal health. So that's just one particular issue. We also have a girls mentoring program. We currently have 22 young girls between the ages of 6th through 8th grade in our STEM program. So it's a mentoring STEM program. We do everything from coding to robotics to field trips. Last Saturday, we had an end of the year closing ceremony. So it is a 5-year program. And our goal with that particular program is that we want to ensure that urban Black girls are on a trajectory for college. We'd hope that they study STEM, science, technology, engineering, or math. But if they don't, our goal is we want them to go to school. And then before going to school, we want them to be prepared. And I'm not going to get into all of that preparation that we talked to them about, especially if they're first generation college kids. Myself, I was a first generation college kid, and there was a lot I didn't know going to school. So what we're doing is we're getting them ready. We're looking at their grades, making sure they have the right maths, they're taking the right English, maybe AP courses. A lot of times it takes a village. And within that village, the Coalition of Black Women, we're helping the students kind of navigate that process successfully, so that they can be successful as first generation. In addition to that, we also work with parents and we talk to parents about what type of summer programs you want to make sure your girls are in. And if we need to sponsor girls to attend a 2-week coding camp, we will pay for those girls to go to a 2-week coding camp or something along those lines. So they have that exposure, which actually prepares them for the next grade because they have a little bit of coding, a little bit of extra math under the belt. So they're not just having a great time. I will say summers are a time to have fun, but I just always believe that you've got to spend 1 or 2 weeks, reading. You should be reading throughout the entire summer, but reading or studying or doing something enriching your education during that span. The other thing that we do, so we talked about education and mentoring. We've talked a little bit about health. Maternal health is just one aspect. We do a lot through health. We also have economic empowerment. We have financial literacy information. We also have workshops for Black women around investing, stock market, credit repair. All of that is around economic empowerment. We do special sessions around entrepreneurship. That's an option for individuals who may be in transition. What are you good at? What do you like? And we bring in professionals. And many of our women, they're professionals in their own right, so they may be presenters. But in most cases, we contract individuals to come in. Since COVID, we've been doing quite a bit on Zoom. But and when we can, we meet in person. We have a light fare, light dinner, and then we have a presentation with a special speaker. And these are all free to the community. And then last but not least, we work with legislators, like I mentioned with the maternal health. Here in Connecticut, there's a bill, a Senate bill number, 386. I'm sorry, I don't know. It's something 86, 586. But it's a Senate bill around maternal health. And it lists all of the, not really demands, but requirements that we, as the Coalition of Black Women, support when it comes to maternal health. Access to doulas, access to pumps, to express their milk, access to assistance with understanding nutrition when you're pregnant. There's all of these things that we take for granted, but because like I said before, knowledge is power, which you don't know what you don't know. And if you have a young woman who's pregnant for the first time, she's trying to make her ends meet, working every day, she may not put enough effort into reading and exploring what should I be doing as a new mom to be? What do I need to do to make sure my child is healthy? They're thinking about, okay, I got to buy a crib. I got to do this. I got to do, you know, all of this. And I need to work in order to have the resources to purchase what I need to set up a nursery. I'm calling it a nursery, but it may not even be a nursery. Maybe a corner of their bedroom. So my point is, because of so many barriers where you have mothers who are working and they can't necessarily take the time to breathe and say, hey, let me read this pamphlet I'm preparing. We bring it to them and give them information. So those are the four key areas. That's just very, very high level overview of what we do on education, health, economic empowerment, and public policy.
No, yeah,
that
amazing.
Your question.
It definitely so, answered the question.
Yeah. Let me say one other thing about the coalition. We do have, I don't know if I mentioned, there are 62 chapters nationwide, and we have about 3,000 members nationwide. Our headquarter office is in Atlanta, Georgia, and I am a national director. I was just voted in at the 2021 National Biennial, and I am the chartering president for the New Haven Metropolitan Chapter. Our chapter started about 7 years ago, where a few, and again, I call them courageous, 35 courageous women came together to bring the advocacy piece to the Greater New Haven and Bridgeport areas. So again, we're only 7 years old, and I was the first president of my chapter, and I was the chartering president.
Amazing, yeah, amazing. You've definitely given us some background to NCBW, sorry, the hard acronym. And
or you can say story. The coalition, Catherine, if you want. Just say
okay.
The coalition,
the amazing coalition. Definitely given us a lot of insight as to the amazing advocacy and programs going on there. My next question is, do you think there are specific issues, maybe some political issues that you can better address because you are a woman? Do you use a gendered lens when solving problems in your field?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So for example, let's just take maternal health, for example. That's the bill, I think it's 986. I feel we should look it up. It's a Senate bill, and it's hopefully will go to a vote before the end of this Senate session. However, what we do is we reach deep and we tell stories about situations where it's near and dear to us. For example, I'm a part of a book group in my casual have fun life. And within my book group, I did have a mom say that, you know, her daughter was expecting. She was visiting, she lived in New York. She was seeing doctors in New York, and she was complaining about pain and not feeling well. And unfortunately, the doctors weren't listening. And what she decided to do, she had a friend in her women's group who was an obstetrician. So her daughter had to move here to Connecticut and switch and began to go to an obstetrician here in Connecticut, a Black woman who was able to see. And I don't know the details on whether or not there was anything serious going on, but there was something else. There was another layer where they should have run additional tests, but the doctors were just kind of, blowing her, I don't want to say, just treating as if it didn't matter, like she was in her head. Many times we're not listened to, or they think that we can endure stronger pain because we're Black women, which is false. And you know that being a Black woman. So can we, does our gender help us navigate the legislative process? Absolutely, because this way we can tell true stories. Even for example, with back on the end of March, sorry, I get my days mixed up. Maybe it was early April. The National Coalition of 100 Black Women made a national day on the Hill. So with that, we spoke with legislators about issues near and dear to us. With our Connecticut delegation, we spoke with legislators about voting rights. And I tell a story that was true and near and dear to me. How my daughter, when she was an undergrad at Spelman College, how she and a group of friends were trying to vote in Georgia, and they were denied. They were told to go to one particular poll place to vote, and then they were given the runaround. And she called me up and says, Mom, they're not allowing us. I'm with my friends and I spoke. We had to call our local NAACP office here. And they called the NAACP office there. And ultimately, I'm going to say it took hours to resolve the issue. However, the girls had an opportunity to vote after. But again, it was because of it was an ID situation. They were blocking because of ID. She had an out-of-state license. So then she had to prove she was a student. And she proved that she was a student, not just her, but she had a group of, you know, maybe like 15 of the girls were going to vote together, and maybe 16. And it's a barrier if they had, for example, if they had been run back to class, or maybe someone had a job, they wouldn't have ever had an opportunity to exercise their vote because of that. So it's being able to leverage some of the stories that we've experienced in order to move legislation, because those stories are real. And it's important that legislators hear how these barriers have affected us personally. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. That was a phenomenal answer. And thank you for the story as well. I guess somewhat along those lines, in your experience, is there a difference between women's and men's use of political power?
Of course. I think, well, of course, you know, you think about this whole abortion rights when and men are making decisions for women's bodies. And I have a as a mom of three daughters, and I have one niece. I feel strongly, and just seeing you, you know, just you know, I just have a passion for young girls, and I just can't fathom in my head that someone else is making decisions when it comes to what choices they make for their bodies. I think there's a huge gap in the voices that are at the table. We're not represented. I think that legislators try incredibly hard to elect officials that can represent them. But with all the gerrymandering and redistricting, we don't have enough voices at the table to make decisions. So to answer your question, yes, I believe there's a huge barrier where I think white men are making decisions for all women, not just Black women. All women, you don't have enough representation. I think representation does matter. But I think that they're the barriers are the redistricting and all of the gerrymandering, where they've decreased and they've taken away. And unfortunately, with the census that just recently took place, they've taken away a few seats from some of the urban communities. And that was done because some folks were afraid to complete the census. So I believe there was an undercount there. So therefore, you know, services that filter through the community, oh, they only have X amount in their population, so they don't need as many legislators. And then they take someone away. So they're decrease in representation. So I think there's a very intentional, concerted effort when it comes to women's bodies and women's rights, and also our right to vote freely in these elections. And men are, I believe, at the helm of it. And I don't want to sound like a male basher, because my husband always says, I think you're going off on a tangent. So I don't want to go off on a tangent. I want to stick to your questions.
No, I think that was definitely within the line of the question. Okay. Yeah, throughout our course, sometimes it also sounds like we're going on tangents when we just, you know, speak freely about these issues. But yeah, amazing.
Let me just say one other thing to this. What I also find is that even in the classroom, I'm not a teacher, but I have friends who are teachers. They would, when my girls were really, really little, they would kind of coach me. You want to make certain that your girls are not intimidated by the boys in the classroom, because the boys will, unfortunately, sometimes girls can be seen as invisible, especially Black women can be seen as invisible. Your voice doesn't have, and that's why people will say, oh, she's an angry Black woman because she's speaking the loudest. No, I'm just trying to talk over you. Or maybe they're the youngest in their family, and the oldest kid always had all the airtime, and the middle daughter didn't have nothing to say. And then the baby's trying to, hi, I got something to say. But, and so therefore the voices are a little louder. But I think that it's important to realize it starts very, very young, Catherine, where boys are, if you do the research, if a boy and a girl raises their hand to answer a question, 9 times out of 10, I won't say 9 times out of 10, because that's not what this, I think it's like six out of 10 times the boy is chosen over the girl. And then that gives her like this, oh God. And she may shrink in her seat and not want to participate. And then it goes, carries out through life. Even in a setting where you're working as a director, and you're working in a setting when a senior management team, you may have an idea. You need to write it down. Because people will, my daughter has this experience all the time. And then she'll have to say, so you're saying, you're agreeing with my suggestion. We give her tools to kind of cope with that. But she's also in a Black project management group, and they're older people, and they help her navigate that as a woman, and how your ideas and your voice is stolen from you. Because it does happen. You'll see. Hopefully by the time you're working and you're out in the main, no, it's still going to be there. So I hope it's going to be gone, but it will be. But to answer your question, yes, there are spaces where men's voices drown out women's, and we can be the majority in the room. And unfortunately, it's not the amplified voice. The amplified voice is, it's a male when you think about gender.
Yeah, unfortunately. That may be changing soon, and that kind of goes into my next question. Africa has now had a few women presidents, and we now in America have a Black woman as vice president. What do you think either women or the Black community can do to sustain this progress of getting Black women into political positions and political advocacy?
That's a very, very good question. I want to just go back to just gender first, and then I'll answer your question if you don't mind.
No,
if
yeah,
you
that's
think
fine.
About Hillary Clinton, who ran for president, I think that told it all. Because white women didn't vote for her. And that's how they lost. That's how she lost. But she didn't, she could have done a better job with Michigan and some other states. But I think that men do not, I think it's tough for women to get elected if they're waiting for men to rally around them to help. Because I think it's a gender thing. I don't want to get on a soapbox, but I think that was a telltale. I couldn't believe it. She was well qualified. She had all the credentials. She paid her dues. What I mean by that, she's was a Secretary of State, and she's done that. She's been in politics all of her life. She understood it, and she still couldn't break that glass ceiling. So when you look at Black women, I believe we could, you know, obviously we were very, very competent and extra smart, and we could do the job. However, we need to rally around each other. I think there are enough individuals here in the country to elect a Black woman, but we have to put the right candidate forward. I love Kamala Harris, but I think, again, there's an effort to discredit her and to say, oh, if she has one little flub of a word, it's a big deal. And you know how many men who've been in that position who've said things, but they were still on a trajectory to be president. But they at one point there was a talk about, like, you know, oh, she's not going to be the running mate of Biden, that sort of thing, which was fake news, I believe. But I believe in order to do that, to answer your question, we need to have a very intentional effort. The Coalition of Black Women, the Black Women's Agenda, all of these other, not only Black organizations, because I don't believe that it's just the Black organizations. I think that women will support women. It's all about competency and being able to do the job. If she is a competent woman, I think she could beat anyone. And I know that we, you know, you're at an Ivy League. You think about all the women who graduated from all of these, they've all got all these credentials and all these letters behind their names. Very, very competent. And it's a matter of us believing it, rallying behind her. Donating money to the campaign, that's really important, even if it's $10, and also getting the message out what she's going to do for all people. So it's yes, to answer your question, I do believe that we can get someone elected, but it would have to be a movement, almost like an Obama movement, very grassroots, where it starts from the bottom up. Community by community by community, and it has to be a swelling a big, and it doesn't necessarily, people will say, oh, Michelle Obama could be president. That's because folks love her, her garden, her this, let's move campaign. She did little things in order to put those buzzwords out there. Whoever was her marketing person would have to be the person for this particular person, because it would have to be someone who is not only competent, but people would need to like as well. So we could do it because we can multitask and do everything, in my opinion. But I think that it would have to be a movement where not just, you know, obviously you listen to Clyburn, he represented, and he says, okay, we got Biden elected. That's true. Same thing like that happened. It could happen for a Black woman. So it's all about a grassroots movement where everybody in pocket starts small in someone's living room. And if it starts in someone's living room, you get, you know, 50 people doing living rooms, then it's 500 folks doing living room. And that's where the swelling begins. And the messaging has to be, what is she going to do for all people, not just Black people? Because then that you get all types of folks supporting her. And because men, we're not going to be able to depend on men. I hate to say it. Some men, younger men will, but I don't know that the older men, besides my husband, will vote for a Black woman. I think that the younger folks will, of course, because they just want a good candidate who believes what they believe in, and, you know, voting rights and you know, women's having choice for their bodies and so on and so forth. But when it comes down to it, there, I think there's going to be a big divide between gender, the older gender. I think white women would vote for a Black woman. I really do. I think that they see the what happened with not voting for Hillary Clinton. So I think that that would not happen again. So I hope that kind of, I think like I was all over the place with that answer, but I do believe that it has to be grassroots, and it needs to start community by community. And then it just spreads out like wildfire throughout the entire country. And, you know, this woman could definitely do well, but it's all about messaging and marketing and making certain that whatever she says that she's going to do, it has to be something that's passionate. She has to have a great story. Folks love a wonderful story. They'll fall in love with her. So I think that she could do it. A Black woman could do it.
Yes, I hope so as well. I definitely think it is also, yeah, a community by community effort. It can't just be done like on a national stage, like all at once. Just a few more questions here. One more question about like Black political leadership in that space, in that arena. Do you feel as though women in positions of power, particularly Black women, are scrutinized more heavily on certain issues, not only their competence, but things like their physical appearance, their clothing, their family? Have you had any exposure or experience with this? And could you share any stories or examples?
Sure, absolutely. So I've worked, so just to give you a little bit of background on me, I do have an MBA. I did my MBA when my kids were very, very small. And I was a stay-at-home mom for many, many years. And I just believe, and then when I wasn't, and my kids went to school, so, you know, they were really little, I didn't work. But then when they when all three were in school, not college school, but I'm saying elementary, I went to work, but I worked part-time. So it was always home. When my kids get out of school, I was home. I did have a job one time overnight where I did some stuff like late night, but I was there to get them off in the morning, and I slept, and then when they came home, I was home. And then at night, I went back to work. But because of that, I will say that, I'm sorry. I was telling you for a reason. What was your question again?
No, yeah, it was just, do you feel so Black women are scrutinized more heavily on things like their appearance and
so,
such?
So when I re-entered the workforce, I went to work for a nonprofit, and the executive director or the president of the nonprofit was a Black male. And so I was always able to wear, I had natural hair from after I had my first kid. Because I didn't work full time, and it was more cost effective to wear my natural hair, because I did wear like waves and relaxed hair and all of that way back when. My oldest is 30. So I'm saying that to say I was not scrutinized over any of my clothing. I wasn't scrutinized, but I am going to share a story with you with my daughter who worked for a government agency when she first got out of undergrad. And she was a computer science major. So she did stuff in IT. And her hair was like yours at the time. Now she has locks, sister locks. And, you know, she would wear twist outs, or sometimes she would get braids, or sometimes she'd part it in the middle and wear, like, I used to say, have you ever heard of this show called Matilda?
Not the show. I know the movie.
Movie, rather. And then there was this little girl named Lavender.
Oh, yes, I know exactly what you're talking about.
So the lavender braids, my daughter would wear the lavender braids to work. So the reason I'm sharing the story with you is she quit her job because of the way she, you know, people would always ask questions about her hair. So if she, you know, sometimes she'd put in extension braids, right? So she'd get her hair braided. Wow, for her, she was so leave my hair alone type of thing. So there was always questions about the hair or comments. And it was a casual work environment. So she could wear jeans, or she could wear, you know, casual clothes, not sweats, but like jeans and a nice sweater or top. So it was never her clothes, but it was always her hair. She's never had a relaxed in her life. So she's always been natural. And she really had a problem with that, Catherine, in terms of just, she ultimately found another job. And I had to, we had to coach her and say, everywhere you go, someone's going to have something to say about something. And we just had to kind of program her that to kind of desensitize. So she's not like always quitting her job over stuff, but she's got a better job. She does well. But my point in saying that is it's, I think younger women like yourself, especially if you've got credentials, you've got a master's and you've got all this stuff going for you. Like, listen, I'm not putting up with this. I got people calling me. I'm leaving type of thing. But when you go to your next assignment, there's always someone that's going to say, wow, nice hair, or, you know, something. And I guess there's a compliment, and then there's an intrigue, like a wow type of thing. And she would sometimes, if she had taken her hair out, she'd wear the puff, put the band on, and she'd wear a puff. And she said that's when she would get most of her comments, because it looked almost like an afro. So she wears a twist out, wasn't really like, it is full like yours, but it's not like afro. And so she would get a lot of remarks when she'd wear the puff. And she resented it. I haven't experienced a lot of that. I don't recall ever experiencing, because I worked for a lot of nonprofits. Like, this is a nonprofit, and my CEO is an amazing Black woman. So I don't have any, I've never had major problems in my workplace like that. I will say, though, it can be a distraction for the individual on the receiving end, because I think diversity and sensitivity training is important. I think there's a lot of microaggression in the workplace. And I know that's not the question you asked, but I'm relating it to individuals saying stuff to, especially young, I'm saying other women, women, because a lot of times older folks won't put up with it. They'll look at you and almost curse you out, like, you know, say something like that. But, you know, Tiffany would let it land on her, and she would complain to myself and my husband, Gary, and say, Mom, this happened, that happened, you know, that sort of thing. I'm quitting if it happens again. And guess what? She started looking and she didn't end up leaving. Now, my oldest daughter, she never ever complained about the workplace and her hair. But Tiffany, for some reason, it really bothered her. I'm sure that everybody experiences it, where, especially if you're the only Black woman in your department, you are on your team and you got a team of engineers that you're managing, and they're all white men. And maybe there's one woman, and, you know, she always gets compliments, and it bothers her because she feels as if, you know, these people need to leave me alone. So the way it's landing on her is, it's like it's not really a compliment type of thing.
No, yeah, it's othering.
And the other thing, yes, you're making a good point. And the other thing too is once she had a person ask to touch her hair, she almost had a baby. I'm putting it like she, it was incredible. She called immediately and was having like, I can't believe blah, blah, blah. And it was a white woman who was not within her department, but just, you know, someone was asking about the hair and just want to touch it. And, oh, you know, almost like you're a pet. Let me just pet you. You know, it's that type of thing. And that's what lands on her. So, and it's real. It's real. And I validated it. And we just try to talk off the ledge. Guess what? You have a rent to pay. Now she's got a mortgage to pay. You know, she's fine now. So it's not happening in her current workplace. She did make a complaint, I will say. She shared with the individual how it made her feel. And the person actually broke down. And said it, you know, wouldn't happen again. She appreciated sharing. So I think there's a sense of not knowing, like you don't know what you don't know. But when you call someone on it, they're embarrassed and they feel as if, wow, you know, thanks for bringing that to my attention, that kind of thing. So hopefully that answers your question. But I've never really had major that kind of happened to me.
No,
One thing
yeah.
I will say this just shifting gears and not dealing with hair, but I think that Black women experience a level of, and this didn't happen to me, but in my book group, individuals will talk about work being checked. So you're on a team and you have a project you're working on, and maybe you got one piece of the work, you've completed your assignment, you submitted it. You know, to the group, and you're packaging it all together. You may have at least one or two folks that don't look like you think that your work is incompetent or maybe not thorough or not complete, and maybe want to double check. And guess what? And you may have the PhD, and they're just a BS. I mean, bachelor's. I shouldn't say BS.
No.
Even that too. They're a BS. No, I'm just kidding. But you know, it's you've got more credentials and letters behind your name, but they're checking your work. And 9 times out of 10, they don't know that you were magna cum laude and valedictorian, whatever, all the stuff. And you don't have to say that because you know your stuff. And that happens. I know that it's not dealing with hair, but it has to do with your blackness and the fact that they don't believe that you're smart enough or you're whatever enough. So I hope that answers your question.
Yes, amazing. Again, all these answers are incredibly phenomenal. These last few questions, they're all very related to one another, so I'll just ask them all at once. It's really just asking for guidance and your own advice as a leader. What is leadership to you? What does it mean to be a good leader? How would you describe your leadership style? And is there any advice you can give to the next generation of Black female leaders?
Sure. So to me, leadership is empowering others to be their personal best. That's really important. And also giving guidance, setting the agenda with buy-in. So you can't just say, this is what we're going to do, but it's collaborating, making certain. So yes, you know what you want. But you have to make folks understand that it's a really kind of a group effort, and you're kind of just bubbling it up and discovering it. You know what the end game is because you have your directive. Where, for example, even with the coalition, so for example, there's two types. So you know, I run a department here, right? So I give vision, I give directive, we have a strategic plan. So yes, we have all of that in place. But once that was done, we rolled it out with the team. I talked to them about it. What do you think? We did a little bit of tweaking, but ultimately, I had to present it to the CEO for her approval. And she had already given me what deliverables she wanted. So I knew what it had to be. But in order to get full buy-in, it's important that it's collaborative and you have all the players. And when I mean by all the players, those individuals doing the work, you want buy-in. So this way, they're committed to the project or committed to the goals or committed to the plan. And that's really important. However, with the coalition, leadership is a little different because it's a complete volunteer organization. The most important thing is you got to lead by example. So, you know, I look at it differently where if we're advocating for Black women and girls, for example, with our STEM, I remember when I was the when I was president, we do have a first vice president, second vice president, third. The first vice president's in charge of programs. So it was really important. And we have, according to the coalition, in order to maintain your charter, there's certain programs that you have to do. And I know that because I used to be on the president's calls, and they talk about, you want to make sure your brand is this, you're doing this type of outreach, not outreach is like service, but this type of advocacy. So there's all these buzz things you have to do, right? So although we've shared that and we trickled all the information down to the chapter, it's important that I lead by example. So if I were to say we're gonna work with STEM, I don't mind going and being there and just being a photographer. So it's not like it's authoritarian type of system where you're just telling people what to do and they're beneath you. No, we're one team. There's, for example, if we're doing corsages, the president doesn't get a corsage. Everybody gets a corsage. You know what I mean? It's one team. There's no hierarchy where there's a pyramid and you little folks and I'm up top. It's not like that at all in the coalition, because we're all striving to transform lives for Black women and girls. And I have to say it and I have to be about it, because talk is cheap. I mean, in my opinion, I mean, it's all about action. So how do you get there? How do we do it in a way that we all are feeling good about this project? And that's bringing everybody's voice here. We can say, this is the goal. How do we get there? And so for me, leadership is empowering others to come up with a plan, to execute, and be successful. And the ultimate goal is to really see the change in the lives of individuals. That's the coalition side. I would say my leadership style, I am a type A individual. I do have, and I'm being very transparent, I do have a, if you can't do it, I will do it type of mentality, because we're such a, it's like a coalition, because we're a new chapter, the goal is we want to be under the radar. We don't want to be not in good standing and jeopardy of losing charter. We put too much money in, too much effort, too much work to let it go. So I do have a style where I want to see, I want to know, not micromanage because I'm not president anymore, but I'm always like chit-chatting with the presidency, texting, you know, okay, remember this, remember that. So my style is I don't need to jump in, but I want to coach others who like the wind beneath their wings to help them move up and elevate the organization. I think my style here at work, very laid back. I support my team. You know, if they say this has happened, that's happened, I go to bat for them. However, and that's empowering, because then they know that you've got a director that's supporting you and not necessarily always taking you down, that sort of thing. They work harder, not harder, but they're more efficient. And they feel good about their workplace when they feel empowered. I mean, when they feel supported. I also believe that once someone, you know, if someone's lying or misrepresenting the truth, it for me, that's a real turn off. Then I just really start documenting. And so my style is I'm very, very laid back, low key. If someone needs time off, sure. I really don't mind if you have the time. And if you don't, if you need to borrow it from next year, that's okay too. Because the key is we want you to feel good about working, especially if you do a great job in your job. I'm very, very low key. However, in the event the CEO has a complaint or something like that, I want to get to the root of it and make sure it doesn't happen again. I'm not afraid to write someone up, put a warning in the file, and talk about it, have a discussion. And, you know, and I'm going to be frank with you. My personality is, and I did share it, my team knows this, we talk about a situation once, the next time it goes in writing as a warning, and the next time we take steps for termination. Only because I'm very laid back, very, 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 very laid back. And I don't nitpick over things, especially if the work is getting done. So that's my style. The advice I would say to young Black women is remember my, I believe it was Maya Angelou said once, the late Maya Angelou said, people will remember how you made them feel, not necessarily what you say. So you want to make folks feel good, and that's your influence power. I do believe that Black women, you are your own superpower, and you need to know it, believe it, and walk in it. And I think, and this is what I've said to my kids when they were very little, and I praise God because they're all soaring and doing fabulous things and doing what they do. But I think it's important to know at a very young age, you're just destined for greatness. And if you know that and you walk into that and believe it, whether you're an author, whether you're a big entrepreneur, whether you are working at a company doing IT, whatever engineering, whatever you decide to do, that space that you're in, just know that you're great at it. And you choose it because that's what you want to do and you're passionate about, whether you're a chef, whatever, that's your greatness. And so that's advice I would say. And you don't necessarily need to be a leader is a mindset, right? So when someone says, oh, I work for so-and-so, and they may not feel as if they're in whatever capacity, you may lead in your household. And what I mean by that is even by having children, you're grooming these boys and girls to be good people. That's leadership in my head. So it's making certain that you overwrite, and even when, you know, I know you're young, so you're not there. When you have your children, you want to lead. You want to overwrite any tapes that they hear from the outside world. When they come into your house as a safe space, you want them to share. You want to listen. You want to check teachers almost every day if you have to, because those are your little people, and you're grooming them to be president, or you're grooming them to be a CEO, or you're grooming them to be a master chef, or you're grooming them to be an amazing artist. You know what I mean? So I'm saying that leadership, the advice I would give you is just to walk in your truth, be a woman of faith, and pray, whatever your faith is, and believe it. Believe it and know it. And don't be afraid to give a hand up and share that with others and help them believe in themselves. One of the things I do is, especially people I don't know, if I see someone, I'm always kind of smiling and imparting good energy on them, especially people who I know are marginalized. You know, folks go through quite a bit. And Catherine, it's amazing how we can, and maybe because I you know, I grew up in the projects, and then, you know, I don't know what I didn't know. And then, you know, we've done okay. And I, thankfully, my kids won't ever experience stuff that I've gone through. But I'm saying all that to say that sometimes people are really struggling, and a smile will lift their day, or something positive, especially when I see women with natural hair. I'm like, oh gosh, you are so sharp. You know, that kind of thing. And they don't have to have lipstick and lashes and all that stuff. It's just their presence and their glow, and letting them know that it brightens their day. And now they're able to go home to their children and feel just a little better. You know, you never know what people are carrying. So the advice I would say is just to walk in your truth, whatever it is, and believe that you're just destined to be great in all that you touch, all that you do, and it will materialize. And share that with your friends. Spread your it's contagious, you know, if you know what I mean. And I really do believe that. I have people who say to me, I can't believe all of your girls have done such and such, not one thing, you know, is doing. I said, listen, because I didn't have it any other way. I put so much, you know, sweat equity, not sweat equity, but so much love into them that they have to. Now, am I saying they don't party? Of course, I'm sure they party. I'm sure they do whatever they do. But when it comes down to taking care of business and they're kind-hearted and good people, I do know that the kids and my niece, and I'm praying that we can get my nephew there. It's, boys are a little different. And I guess that's what God bless me for with girls, but I think that I think that this was a delight to chat with you. I don't know if you have more questions, and I hope I was able to answer everything to you. I was being very authentic and letting you know. And I pray that you know this goes well. What are the next steps? Where does this go?
Oh yeah, so now we are at the end of our interview here. Here, I'll actually stop recording. Thank you so much for speaking with me. I'll stop recording and
But Catherine, before you start